Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm your host today, Al Warren. Joining me is Mike Brown.
Hello.
It's good that you're sounding good today. You've been in such a bad mood this last, I don't know what's wrong with you, you know?
I'm feeling a little more chipper.
Chipper, that's a squirrel.
Yeah.
So now, today, actually on the phone, we got him here now so we can just tease him live. We've got an author called Frank W. Butterfield. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. Real pleasure to be here, be with you guys.
We'll see if you say that in an hour. Well, you are a big time writer. You write a lot of books. So, wow. Have you been writing all your life? Is this something you've done since a little kid, or is it something that came on later?
Well, I did write my first mystery when I was 9 years old. It was about a 3-page thing. And when I showed it to my mother and grandmother, my grandmother pointed out that somehow or another she was the victim and she wasn't very pleased with that. So I didn't write anything else until I was in my 30s. And then I tried to write a mystery and kind of got bogged down in a couple of things and then just forgot about it. I picked it up when I was 49, and which was, it'll be 5 years ago this May, and had been writing kind of slash fic, if you know what that is, and realized that I could write. I was just writing for fun. And so I sat down one day and was like, okay, I want to write an actual book that I can publish. I already knew how to do self-publishing because I'd done that on a nonfiction basis, but I wanted to see if I could publish or write a novel that people would read, and apparently so. So that's where my first novel came from, The Unexpected Heiress, and that came out on June 1st of 2016.
So when that happened, so when you were writing that, decided you want to, you're going to write something, have someone publish it, but what was the thing that gave you the confidence to actually send it to a publisher or to just do that? When did, like it takes a lot of confidence, because myself writing, even I find that you can write and then you look over it and you kind of go, well, I need to change this, need to add that, or I don't like this. So there's always this thing going on in your head. There must be a time when all of a sudden you go, yeah, this is good. I can do this.
Yeah, and it wasn't just one moment, but there were two or three things that happened. The first of which was that I actually wrote something and finished it, which for me is a big deal. The second thing was that I realized, because I was going the self-publishing route, I don't play well with others, so I cannot imagine having a publisher. I just can't imagine what it would do to them. So I knew I was going to self-publish, and I knew that if I was going to do this, that I was going to make mistakes, and that was going to have to be okay, and that I was going to have to be okay with failing and with people not liking what I was writing. And once I got okay with that, then everything just kind of clicked into place. I also had a friend who had already published a novel, and I ran it by him, and he read it. He loved it, and that shocked me, because I kind of figured he'd be a little dismissive. And that was probably, if there was one moment, it was probably that. But I was already kind of on a roll by then, and I knew that the bottom line, and it's still the bottom line, particularly when reviews come in, that if I'm not writing what I want to read and I'm not writing what I would like to write, there's no reason to do it, because it's too much of an emotional investment if I'm going to be worried about what other people think about it, even though I did kind of finally get off my, like, okay, can I do this or not do this, once somebody told me I could. But I realized the only way to keep going would be just to realize, if I fail, I fail. If people don't like it, they don't like it, and that's okay, because I'm just going to keep writing the stories I want to read and the stories I want to be involved in, and that's what I've done.
Okay, so listen, you have to tell me the truth here, because when did you get mentally stable? I mean, because that's a big thing for all of us, because nowadays social media is such a big part of everyone's life in North America and a lot of the world. So where did you get that confidence and that, well, if you don't like it, too bad. Like, it's that Howard Stern-ish, well, here's what it is. You don't like it, turn your channel or whatever. How can you be so comfortable with that? Like, because I'm still not that now. And I don't know how many books I've got out, 16, 18, I can't. I still don't feel that confidence to say where reviews don't matter, or what other authors say, or what people say. I go up and down like a toilet seat.
Well, so do I. Lest it sound like I'm just this 100% absolutely committed to kind of person, I'm not. But one thing I have learned, and I've learned it from my mom, I've learned it from other people in my life, is basically the, for lack of a better way of putting it, the power of willingness, particularly the willingness to fail. If you're willing to fail, then all of a sudden all this stuff doesn't matter anymore. If you know, like, okay, well, this could absolutely crash and burn, but I'm going to do it anyway because I like what I'm doing, then all that other stuff, it doesn't go away, but it fades away. Now, we'll tell you, I do have some little mental tricks. Like, when I read a bad review, if it's an intelligent bad review, because there are unintelligent ones, and it really hits me hard, I'll sit with it and just let it burn. It's one of those powerful things I ever learned, and that's something I learned, again, from my mom, to just sit there and let something burn through you. And instead of trying to, like, drag it through a day or two or three or four and deal with it slowly over time, just go ahead and sit down and feel awful about it. And that, it's amazing what that can do. But it really just, to me, comes down to, if I'm willing to fail, then I can pretty much do anything I want to do. And I really am doing what I want to do. So, you know, I could say I'm lucky, but I would really say that it's just that I've had some really amazing people in my life that I've known over the years, who have helped me discover these things. I wish I could say I came up with them on my own, but I didn't.
But, so, you know, I was going to say, so it's kind of like ownership for what you do.
Yeah.
Like, this is who you are. This is what I do. This is how I do it. And you own it. Some might do well, some might not.
Right. Exactly.
Wow. It's a good place to be in. So now you write it's all crime fiction, is it? Or how would you describe your writing?
Well, I would say the majority of it is crime fiction. Most of it is historical, although I do have, because I have three series that are in running. They're all in the same universe, but they're all set in different times and places. Two of them are, well, one of them is crime, mystery, adventure, thriller kind of stuff. That's my main series. The other one is more of legal procedural. And then the third is more, it's romance with all sorts of things thrown in. It's just like a series that I write because I want to play with all sorts of ideas. And so the first series, the one that's mostly crime, is, well, it's now called The Adventures of Nick and Carter. The first one was the Nick Williams Mystery Series, and that was a series of 32 novels, which I wrapped up in 2019. And that's the one I started with. The Unexpected Heiress is the first title in that series. It starts in 53 and ends in 67. And now the ongoing series, which I wanted to broaden out a little bit, not just always make it about crime mystery, is called The Adventures of Nick and Carter. And that starts in 1970. And we'll go through their deaths, which will be 2008, which everybody knows that I'm not giving anything away there. But my legal procedural is set, I live in Daytona Beach in Florida, and my legal procedural is set here in the 40s. And I like to call it Perry Mason at the Beach with a twist. Because it's like Perry Mason and his private detective are lovers. That's essentially what it is. And they're dealing, but they're not dealing with California stuff. They're dealing with Florida stuff. And in the 40s, Florida stuff is great for plots. There's just so many things that can happen here. So those are my two that are focused on, that are mysteries. So even in the legal procedural, there's still a mystery and they're still solving, you know, they have basically end up solving crimes like Perry Mason did. Just not as directly as a private detective or as a sleuth, but rather in the legal process. So,
so when you're doing the period pieces, like there's, so they're set in different times. Are the time periods really part of, are they actually a character in themselves?
Yes, absolutely. And what's interesting is now having written a series that's basically almost 20 years in length, things change. There's a huge difference from, you know, 1953 to 1967 in American culture. Huge, huge difference. Because the early 50s is more like the 40s and the late 60s is more like the 70s, you know, on and on and on like that. But, and also they're getting older, the characters. And so they're dealing with things that happen as they age and they become more mature and they, you know, become less like this and more like that. So yeah, well, time is really would be the character, not so much the time period, but time itself and the passage of time.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, because that must be the hardest or the most timely part of your research, because you have to get the things correct in a certain time period.
Yes, and I have made some wowzer kind of mistakes, some serious mistakes, but thanks to the miracle of electronic publishing, most of those have been corrected. But yeah, no, that is the way I do it now is when I'm starting a new story, the first place I go is the newspaper. And then I'll read the newspaper like the few days before the story's going to start. From, you know, that time from whenever that was. And then I'll sometimes read Life magazine, which for up until the 70s is a really great way of getting some insight into the culture. Then sometimes I'll go read Time magazine and National Geographic, just different things like that, to get a clue of kind of what's going on outside, you know, the personal lives of the people that I'm writing about. That's really helpful. But it gets me stationed in that time period. And, you know, when I write books back to back to back, which some of those in the first series are back to back, you know, I just have to get established in one particular moment, and then that takes care of itself and run with that. But yeah, that's a big part of the research, and also researching locations and making sure I'm getting people placed in the right time, in the right place, in the right way, because some buildings that exist now did not exist 50 years ago, 70 years ago, and that's the big first mistake I made. There's a Grace Cathedral, which is the Episcopal Church Cathedral in San Francisco, in 1953 was not finished. And if you went there now, you would not think that. It looks like it was built in, you know, the early 1900s and just the way that it is. But they stopped building on it when the Depression hit and didn't start back up until the early 60s, something I didn't know. So I have a description, the first version of the first book, there's a funeral that takes place there, and I have a description where they're entering in a door that didn't exist. So when I went back and updated that edition, I just moved things around a little bit and made sure that it was clear that it doesn't look the way that it does now.
So in your story, is your story the most important thing, or are you really concerned with the grammar, you might say, or the wordings?
Well, this, you know, well, it's interesting because one of my best readers is somebody I went to high school with, and we were in all the same English grammar and literature classes together. So every now and then I'll be doing something, and I'll send him a note, and I'm like, you know, Mrs. Kilgore, she was our teacher in the 11th grade. I'm like, Mrs. Kilgore is rolling in her grave if she has any idea what I'm doing with this grammar. She's going to, you know, rise up and, like, haunt me. Because the grammar, the wording, it's important, but it's important to set the mood and the tone of what's going on in the story. It services that. So the story is more important. I've even had readers, because the main character, who's the primary narrator in the first series, Nick Williams, he had a privileged background. He grew up on Knob Hill. He went to a private school, both for grammar school and high school, and should be, and actually was well-educated to a point. And so I've had people actually write me and be like, when is Nick going to start talking like he's from Knob Hill? And I'm like, never, because it's part of his personality to talk like he's not from there, because he spent a lot of his adult life trying to not be from there. So that, you know, that kind of thing, that setting and tone, it's not, you know, like the elements like weather and grammar and how people speak and how the paragraphs even are structured, in my opinion, really speeds the plow to help you kind of get a sense of where you are when you're reading what you're reading. Yeah. Because, like, I have books where I have really long paragraphs. And that my Daytona Beach books, depending on, because I have five different POVs in that story, but different depending on who's doing it, there will be really long paragraphs. But in the Nick stuff, they're always really short, because he thinks in really staccato kind of ways. He kind of moves very quickly from one idea to another. Whereas I have like a kind of a dreamier character in his inner monologue in this Daytona series. He thinks and thinks and thinks about stuff, and so the paragraphs get really long. Because that he's just kind of off in his own little world thinking about what he's looking at, that sort of thing. So all of that, that structure and the grammar and the tone services the story and reinforces who the characters are and what they're doing. That's the way I see it anyway.
So your character, when you talk about your characters, and first of all, let's go to Nick. So is Nick you or is...
No.
Where does Nick come from then? And who is Nick? Like, how do you create that?
Well, he kind of came sui generis. He kind of came fully formed, like Athena out of the head of Zeus. He just came fully formed. I did have a little bit of trouble at first blending him with Lord Peter, because I am a huge Dorothy Sayers fan. She's my favorite author, period. So... at first, in fact, in the first book, there are these periods where kind of Nick goes over into kind of almost sounding like an aristocrat, an aristocrat. And eventually, it just came to me that it was really clear that his boyfriend, husband, would eventually turn to him and be like, you know, you need to cut that out. And so there's this, there's now kind of a thing that goes back and forth between the two of them, because it became obvious to me that I wasn't putting that in there. That's actually the way Nick talks, is that when he needs to, he can sound like he's from Nob Hill. He can sound like he's high, you know, well-bred and well-raised, all that sort of thing, and can sound very pretentious, which has its effect. And so when he does it in a place and a time when it's not necessary, Carter, who's his husband, will kind of elbow him and say, like, cut out the hi-hat voice, like, stop talking like that. Which, you know, is one of those little things that happens between couples that I always find so wonderful to talk about in books like this.
Well, that's interesting. So how do you feel about your characters? I ask this question because a lot of the fiction authors we've interviewed over the times, quite often they'll say they're like their children. They're like their own sort of entity. Is that sort of how it is with you, or is it something different? It is.
No, that's definitely the case. And there's some of them that I don't like. There's a running character in the first series, in the Nick Williams series, that he cannot figure out where to land. He cannot, he's gay and then he's straight and then he gets married and then he has a kid and then he comes back out of the closet and then he goes back into the closet and it really has to do with, he likes to make money, and so he kind of goes wherever the prevailing winds go. And I really don't like him. And there are others I'm kind of like, okay. And there are others that I write about, and I'm like, I like writing about this person, but if I met them in real life, I would not like them at all.
But how is that to write? How is that to write someone like a character, a main character, especially, that you really don't like, and you don't like their behavior and what they do? What's that like writing that?
Well, with the main characters, because I'd say in my books there are probably there are 9 main characters, pretty much, because there's 2 main characters in 2 of the series, and then 5 in 1 of the series. There's some that I feel closer to and some that I feel more distant from, and some that I really like looking at, like someone across the table. I like watching them and observing them, and some of them I want to get into their heads and figure out what their motivations are. The interesting thing is that I kind of addressed this because I have a contemporary series and the narrator is essentially me. I decided to write because it's just fun to do. I decided to write a book where I would be the main character. And so I kind of figured out all the dynamics of that. And I realized that back in 1990 or 91, that the me, his name is Eddie in the book, would have met Carter in 91 at this one particular bar in San Francisco that I did go to particularly in the spring and summer of 91. And I could even see like, when that would have been and what would have been happening in that bar. And it was one of those things where I could see that I would be sitting at one end of the bar and he would be back at the other end. It'd be the center of attention. I'd be looking at him thinking, I really wish I was your friend and I could get to know you. But also at the same time feeling like, but there's no way that would ever happen because of who you are and what you represent and all that stuff. And that I actually talk about that in one of the books where that actually happens as an event. And I got to explore that of like, well, this is what it would be like to meet one of your own characters. Some of them you would like and some of them you wouldn't really like, but they're interesting and they're fascinating to be around. It's interesting to get in their heads, but you don't necessarily want to spend time with them.
Where do you think they come from then?
The ethers? I don't, you know, they're just as real as anyone else, except for the part where they're not in my proximity. So, you know, that's not a good way to say that, but I could say it metaphysically, and I have a very specific metaphysical way of looking at this, but in terms of practicality, it's just, well, they're just these figments of my imagination that have come to life, and they're very real. I mean, I don't think of them as actually being real human beings, to be absolutely clear, I realize they're my imagination talking, but at the same time, I can feel the tactile reality of them. And sometimes, because smell is one of my major identifiers for things, I can sometimes smell them, which is a really weird thing to say. But like I can, like with Nick, I can sometimes smell, like, if you know the weather in San Francisco, it's cold and damp, sort of, but not all the time. And so people, particularly back in the day, would have been wearing wool, which, and then they would suddenly find themselves on a sunny afternoon that they weren't expecting, so they start sweating under the wool, which is a little bit damp because it was foggy early in the day, and that has a very particular aroma. Not something you would encounter much now because people don't wear wool like they used to, but it's one of those things where every now and then I get a little whiff of, like, oh, that's what Nick would have smelled like a little sweaty, a little like that weird wool wet smell, and then like just the general aroma of what San Francisco smells like, which just has its own smell. So that's every now and then that happens. And I'm like, oh yeah, that would be, that's probably what it would smell like to be around him. Like say in like October of some year.
That's interesting. So no, you say it's a mysteries or crime fictions and stuff. How do you set up the, let's say, crime or mystery that's going to happen? Like, how do you develop that? Where does that come from?
They almost always, they stumble into them occasionally, because just to keep focused on Nick, Nick is a private detective. He becomes a private detective because he needs something to do. He's very wealthy, blah, blah, blah. That's part of the backstory, but he decides to figure out, you know, he meets somebody. I can't even remember the backstory on that, but it happens before we start. And he's a private detective, and he has, the first book is how he sets up his private detective firm, including to bring in other people. And so they have clients. Clients begin to sort of trickle in because they're known to be in 1953, when such a thing would not likely have ever been possible. They're known to be the gay private detectives. So they're, the people who come as clients are like either really desperate or really offbeat, because no mainline person is going to be seen around these people, not in 1953. Now that changes over time, but so like one, in one book, it's very straightforward kind of mystery format, particularly for mid-century, where Nick's sitting there, and the client walks in, and his father and his son is missing, and the father's Czechoslovakian and doesn't really speak English that well, but has lived in San Francisco for like 20 years. And the kid is like an all-American, and he doesn't really understand his son very well. And so then they begin to do the private detective things where they go to the house and they look through the son's bedroom and see what they can find. And they find these little clues, and then one thing leads to another. And that was a lot of fun to write. That was just a really straightforward private detective novel. But others have been, sometimes they fall into stuff accidentally. Like they're building a building and somebody falls off the top floor in the middle of a construction while they're actually building the building. And then that they accidentally fall into what turns out to be this weird loop.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mafia thing that's going on. And San Francisco didn't really have mafia. They had it somewhat, but it was very small compared to other places in the country. And so they are fall into that and they have to deal with that. But basically they're, to be blunt, I don't really set up the stories. So just Nick tells me what happened, and then I write it down, essentially.
Well, so you're hearing voices.
Yeah, well, yes, to the extent that, yeah, except for the part where it's not an actual voice. It's more just like, you know, I just kind of can see it, and then I write it and describe it. And I don't get it all at one time. It's part of what I'm doing is I'm actually reading the book as I'm writing it, which is my favorite thing in the world and why I've tried to plot, and I've plotted one book and it was the biggest mistake I've ever made. But mostly in, to use the term that I really dislike, but it's a pretty common term, is I'm called a pantser, which means I ride by the seat of my pants.
Right.
And, right. You know, Nick just tells me this is what happens. This is what's going on. And I just write it down. And, you know, in these mysteries, in my particular books, there's a lot of development of the relationship between him and Carter that's happening simultaneous to everything else.
That's, you know, so when you seem to have focused a lot on San Francisco, yet you don't live there. Where do you think that comes from? Like, why is it so important?
Well, I did live there, so I have lived there.
Right.
But I'm not writing about San Francisco in its current state. And San Francisco, of all the cities in North America, changes and becomes a different thing pretty quickly. It's one of those things that people who live there, it annoys them greatly. But San Francisco is a very vibrant, dynamic city. And it's, you know, the difference between the San Francisco of like 1875 and the San Francisco of 1975 is not the same as it would be with other cities. It is a radically different city. And that's part of it. It's a very dynamic place, and lots of things happen there. And it's only 49 square miles. It's very small, but a lot of stuff happens, and there's a lot of really interesting stories underneath everything. But also, it's my favorite city in the world, probably, without question.
Yeah. Well, it's got a lot of character. When you talk about, you know, you have the love for old movies and all that, and do you make your detectives like an old type detective? Like, is it kind of like, because you say wisecracking and all that, heart of gold?
Yeah.
Are you kind of going after someone like Richard Diamond, you know, the old Dick
Powell?
Yes, Powell?
Yeah. Well, Richard Diamond's probably, yeah. Richard Diamond of all, the radio Richard Diamond.
Right.
Is probably the closest thing to who Nick is of anybody. I will say Nick Diamond is a little bit darker, which is funny because he was on the radio, so it's not that dark. but he's a little bit darker than Nick. Nick is a little bit more optimistic and a little bit more trusting of other people.
Wow.
You can't really get over him, but because he doesn't have anything to lose. He doesn't need the job that he has. He's wealthy, kind of beyond count. So he can kind of go anywhere and do anything he wants to do. And he wants to help people. That's his number one thing. That's his motivation behind being a private detective and all the other things he gets into. Because he really, really, really has a very strong desire to be not a philanthropist. And he's very clear about this, not a philanthropist in the way that like Carnegie was, but a philanthropist that nobody knows about. That's his favorite thing. Because that's how he started off being wealthy, is that nobody really knew who he was. It was accidental. It fell into his lap. And he hid it for so many years that it just kind of became a habit that he didn't really want to broadcast. But people find out and they know who he is. But he doesn't really ever talk about, there's no Nick Williams memorial, blah, 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 anywhere. Well, that's not true. There is one. In my fictional world, there is a... I don't think it's named after Nick. I can't remember what it's named, but there's a hospital in Hong Kong that's built using his money that has his name or Carter's name. I can't remember which one it is. And I actually had a couple of readers point that out. They were like, wait, he doesn't want his name on anything. I was like, yeah, well, that's part of the story, is his name has to be on it. So.
Well, it's quite a fascinating process here. Do you ever think of making these on audio because someone like Diamond is such a good radio presence?
Well, I actually have three audiobooks already up, so books 1, 2, and 3. I am dragging my feet to get the next two done. I have a narrator that I work with, I really like. So they're on audiobook, but I'm going to go back to my narrator. He doesn't know this yet. If he hears this, he'll be surprised. I'm really thinking about going outside of the realm of straight up audiobooks and doing something a little bit more inventive that would involve like a podcast of some sort. Because audiobooks, they're for self-publishing at least, audiobooks are not, they're hard. They don't sell, not the way that paperbacks are, not even, because I sell more paperbacks than I do audiobooks. And they're not anything like what ebooks are like. But I do love, I mean, my narrator really has the voices down, and he's got the rhythm and the cadence down really, really well. So I like working with him. But yeah, no, what I really like is not only audio, but I'd love to see this filmed. I would love, love, love to see it filmed. And I'm always kind of looking at different actors thinking, who would be Nick and who would be Carter? Because it's fun to think about, but also it would be kind of fun to see, even though I know that I'd probably lose a little bit of control of the story, but it'd still be nice to see it even adapted, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be good to see it up on the screen, but yeah, you do lose. They do want to do it their way. So it's tough.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Really tough. So now your newest project that you got coming out, the biker who got bumped off, maybe give us a little bit of the premise there, the story.
Well, it's pretty simple. It's Daytona Beach book. It takes place during what we call here Bike Week, which is when bikers come to town. It was originally Bike Week had to do with a race, what was called the Daytona 200 and then the Daytona 250 that happened out on the beach. And in 1948, that was the first Bike Week that was really big. And we still have Bike Week. In fact, we're going to have it here in a few weeks. So Bike Week really started being big in 48. So this is centered around that. And there's the basic outline is pretty simple again. There are two rival kind of gangs, but they're not called gangs because it's 48, not 55. And they're both, in both cases, the one gang is from Seattle, one's from Milwaukee, and they're both a bunch of gay men who all knew each other basically during the war. And are just traveling around making trouble or trying to live off the land kind of thing. And one of them is accused of murdering another one. And there's lots of mistaken identity stuff that happens. And essentially through legal stuff, is how things get resolved. So this, again, it's a courtroom procedural that involves lots of little elements of the courtroom. And when I said earlier that there's one book that I plotted and it was a big mistake, it's this book. This book has taken me 2 years to write, which it, for me is about 20 times longer than any book I've ever written. And it's because I've been trying to get all the legal stuff right. There's no, how did Florida courts work in 1948? There's no such resource. I've had to pin it all together myself. And that's been a lot of research, diving deep into all sorts of things, including other crimes that happened at the same time. When I get this book done, I'm going to be very happy. And I don't drink, but I'll probably have an entire bottle of champagne. Because it's just been, this has been a long slog. But I love the story. I'm absolutely adoring the story and cannot wait to get it finished. But that's the book I'm working on. Hopefully, by the time people hear this, it will be ready and done. But we'll see. But if it's not quite done, it will be almost done. So,
yeah. Now, so your books, you're centering a gay character throughout, or gay characters. Do you also get into the details behind being gay and the different times, different cities, and different situations?
Yes.
You do.
Yes.
Is that real important?
Yeah, it's very important. In fact, in this particular book, the Kinsey Report came out in January of 48, and this book takes place in March. So one of the characters has basically taken it on himself that we're not going to call ourselves inverts anymore, because that was a very common Southern thing, was to use the word invert to describe being gay. We're calling ourselves homosexuals, and there's actually, he kind of walks around and corrects other people from time to time, because there's basically all the characters who work in this law firm, with the exception of one person, they're all gay. There's a lesbian and three gay guys, and then one straight woman. And it's, you know, they're very isolated in the sense that they don't really know that there's anyone else like them other than the people who kind of mess around, because there's always straight guys who will mess around with anybody. And those kind of, those, one of the characters in this book is the kind of person who would know that and would know them and probably knew them very well, in fact. But yeah, that's, it's a big part. And I, in the Nick Williams books, the progression of gay rights is a really big part of the story, because Nick essentially is ahistorical. There was nobody ever like Nick, because the first person on the national level in the U.S. who was out was Harvey Milk, and that's 1976. So Nick is out, you know, 23 years before then, and not voluntarily. He's outed. And there really was not anybody like that at all. There's certain people, like everybody kind of knew about Oscar Wilde, but there would always be people who would say, well, no, Oscar Wilde wasn't really like that. Or there was a couple of English authors that everybody kind of knew, yeah, they're probably gay, but maybe not, and it doesn't really matter. There were people who were out to smaller groups of people, like Grace Kelly's uncle, is one of a character that I bring in. He was gay. He was actually kind of openly gay. But nobody really knew that, because there wasn't the mechanism by which to say this is the case. But with Nick, because he's wealthy and because of who he tangles with, it becomes a national known thing. So he's ahistorical. So he's standing there sort of as a counterpoint to what's actually happening in the culture, because they don't change history. But he does encounter some of these historical people. Most of them don't like him. And there's lots of, that's, which is a really complicated thing to explain, but most of them don't like him because he threatens the stability they're trying to establish for themselves, and which is another, brings up lots of interesting plot points, to say the least.
So do you actually have kind of a underlying theme that you want people to get out of the story?
Well, that's, yes and no. I mean, I have my own little axes that I grind to the stories. There's no question. There's they spend some time in Africa in the early 60s, and I write that because I really wanted to point out what white supremacy looks like in practice when it's actually being practiced, this is what it's like and this is the effect that it has. So there's a book that I've set in the Belgian Congo right before it becomes independent, and then a book that I've set in southern Rhodesia. And both of those stories allow me to, like, give my opinion about what that looks like. And researching the book on southern Rhodesia, by the way, was walking through an amazing swamp of white supremacy, because most white supremacists now believe that Rhodesia is kind of the lost kingdom, that if only it had not been turned over to the Africans, that it would still be this wonderful, magical place where everything is done right in Africa, which is really hard to read and hard to kind of dive into. But I think it's an important story to tell. So there's that. I think probably if there's one word I could use for all of this, it would be justice. And I don't mean vengeance. I mean actual justice. Because Nick, and this probably comes from me, Nick is very interested in justice. He's not interested in vengeance. Ever. And in fact, he's yet to actually kill anyone so far in any of the stories I've written. Other people kill people for him, not because he hires them, but because they're saving him or protecting him. But he's actually, although he's a very good shoot, a very good shot, he's never actually killed anyone. He's been accused of doing it, but he didn't do that. It wasn't him who did it. So I guess justice is probably the biggest theme of all of it. And again, not vengeance, but actual justice.
It's interesting. Now, so does your environment affect the way you write? So now this is a question I ask a lot of writers. So the last year, you know, with, you know, the COVID and the Black Lives Matters, the riots, the dingbat orange guy, all of the stuff going on. And all the stress behind it, does that seep into your writing? Like, I know it's error and you're not going to write about COVID or anything like that.
Oh, no. Well, but I do have a contemporary series, and I did write a book set. I have one novel set in March of last year, so right before, and it was set here, right before St. Patrick's Day, which that week was a really big week here for what happened with COVID. But also, they're also in early September in San Antonio, which is part of the plot. And that was fascinating, writing about that, because I had to remind myself constantly, no one is smiling. You can't see anybody's smile. You can't see their face because everybody's wearing masks, which was its own thing. But yeah, what actually has invaded my mental space was not so much the pandemic, because I've been social distancing for several years. I didn't know that's what it was called, but that's what I've been doing. but what's invaded my mental space was the historical aspect of what's been going on with the U.S. government and the impeachments. I'm very interested in that because I'm a historical buff. And so I've been a political buff, and I was spending way a lot of time watching the details of all that. So it kind of slowed down my writing. I haven't written as much in 2020 as I wanted to, and that I could have. But it didn't – there are times when it's like, okay, I just want to go back to 1948 or 1970 or whenever and write about that because I just really don't want to look at 2020 right now. That's been helpful. And one of the things that I actually did to kind of speed that up for myself was I wrote, it wasn't my plan because I started in January, but in 2020, I wrote 25 short stories that were Nick and Carter and it was set in different times of their lives based on holidays. So there was like New Year's Day and then Martin Luther King's birthday, St. Valentine's Day, et cetera. And those bump around in different time periods. And so that was nice because I would get a little escape out of whatever was going on here, and then I'd go back to some random time period, like 1976, and writing about Independence Day in the U.S., which was obviously a really big event because it was 200 years. But, COVID has invaded my contemporary stuff. But other than that, it really hasn't affected me very much. In fact, I just realized today that I only now know people who have it. And these are the first people, and they're my neighbors, actually. These are the first people I actually have met or know of who have it. And I nobody else in my close circle has had it. So it's been kind of at a distance from me personally.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering if when negative things are happening around you, even if it doesn't involve you directly, but, you know, you're watching the TV and you're watching, you know, about the impeachments and all the crazy stuff. I just wonder if you maybe have a darker side that comes out in your writing, maybe.
No, I would say not. Because I do tend to look at things through the lens of, this isn't the right word, but the lens of history, because we're just repeating stuff we've done already, essentially. We're doing it differently, obviously. But, you know, we've been through a pandemic before. It's been 100 years, but we did it before. We've been through pretty much all the stuff that's going on with the government, in the U.S. at least right now. We've been through all this before. Not to quite this extent and not quite this way, but it's just like, you know, like, well, yeah, things come and things go. And if nothing else, writing about history in the way that I've done, it has helped me kind of take a longer view on how things are happening. And Black Lives Matter, in my opinion, is the one thing that I'll say we've never seen before, ever. And I'm really grateful that it's happening. And it's not just an all, you know, dealing with sexual predation, dealing with sexual harassment and assault, dealing with racial systemic racism and racial profiling and all that stuff that we've talked about and talked about and talked about. But now finally something is happening. Something is shifting. I'm really grateful for that. And that's really, I would say those things right there, that's one of the things that is unique. I don't think this has ever happened in any realm, in any contemporary or modern history that I'm aware of, where it's gotten this clear and this precise in terms of looking directly at, okay, this is what is happening here and here and here and here and here. And obviously that has to do with technology. Before, there was never a way to do that. If you found out about something, it would be 2 or 3 days later in the newspaper, or maybe weeks later, depending on how remote it was and when the time period was. And then some things you wouldn't know about at all because they were covered up, and it was much easier to cover something up when there were only a few hundred people who might know about it, not literally millions, within 20 seconds, thanks to Twitter.
Good old Twitter. Wow. So now, do you have a place you'd like people to come find you or stalk you? Do you have like a website that it's good for you?
Yeah, I have a website. It's frankwbutterfield.com. You can see all my books there. You can figure out kind of who I am. You can find me on Facebook. Just Google my name and you'll find me. It's pretty easy. So come and visit. I'm on Instagram too. I just am now realizing I don't actually have links to either of those on my website. That's wow. I can't. How very not 2021.
Yeah, you get on that.
Yeah, I mean, immediately, if not sooner.
Grindr.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, not Grindr. No.
Oh.
No, but thank you.
We have, we're going to have you posted up on our website as well. And we'll have your links up there and your books so people can find you with one click. So awesome. So that makes it easy for them as well. Pretty amazing. Who do you like to read right now? Who are you reading besides yourself?
I'm terrible. I'm reading myself.
Mostly. Oh, okay. Well,
because I'm trying to stay in the time frame and in the mind frame of the time frame that I'm writing about. So I reread the novels in my Daytona Beach series so that I'm real clear about what has happened before. Or because sometimes I just want to go back and read stuff that I don't remember writing, which is happens frequently.
Yeah.
But if I were, I'm just really terrible. I read the same stuff over and over and over again for whatever reason. So it would be Dorothy Sayers or Armistead Maupin, who's my, of the living authors, he's one of my favorites. And somebody that, one of the very few people that I would really, really, really like to meet in person.
Wow, that's interesting.
he's just an amazing, he really captured a time and a place in a way that's really unique that nobody else has really ever done, I don't think. And that's about it. Yeah, I mean, what I like to do is I like to keep my focus on writing, and I try to limit my exposure to other writers and other, not only just through reading, but also through television, so that I keep a kind of a narrow focus. It helps me stay present with what I'm doing.
Where do you see yourself going with this? Are you going to stay? Do you see yourself changing the type of writing you're doing? And, or, you know, 10 years from now, where do you think you'll be at?
Well, 10 years, I mean, considering I've only been doing this 5, 10 is a really long time, but I have some specific goals in terms of Nick and Carter. I want to write about their life essentially as an epic. So we have to get from 1970 to 2008 somehow. And I have some ideas. There will be, when we get to the 80s, I think that I will change some of the way I'm doing stuff, mainly because I just cannot, and I may change my mind about this, but I cannot imagine writing about the 80s in San Francisco on and on and on, because it just seems like, well, we're just going to write about going from one funeral to another. So I've had some ideas about how to actually reflect more broadly what was going on in the culture at that time period, but we'll see. The 70s is going to be, the first short story I wrote last year was set in 79, and let me just say there's a lot of cocaine involved. Not the main characters. They barely drink, and they certainly don't do anything else, but lots of people around them. Because of the 70s, you know, late 70s, with gay men, lots of coke, and lots of other recreational activities like that. So some of it will have to do with that. Like, the way I write about something will change a little bit because the characters are getting older and we're moving through the timeline and different things are happening. But in terms of, like, coming up with a new way of looking at things, that may happen. I mean, the Daytona Beach books was that. They kind of came out of nowhere, and then I'm writing in a very different way. So now, instead of being first character or first person narration, it's 5 characters with their POVs, and that's very different than the first person stuff. So, but I got to get everybody through their lifetime, essentially. I know when both of those series will end. So we just got to get to that point.
Just got to get there. Well, it's been a great conversation, and we appreciate you being on. Our guest has been Frank W. Butterfield. Thank you for being here.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Really, really a lot of fun.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll say it.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.